The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're going to talk about a book that argues that there is a biological basis for race. Strap in. This is Science for the People, and I'm Desiree Schell. We have two guests with us today. Jennifer Raff is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Texas, Austin, with a joint doctorate in genetics and biological anthropology. Her research is primarily focused on characterizing the genetic variation of contemporary and ancient Native American populations. Welcome to the show, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And we also have David Dobbs, who writes books as well as features and essays for the New York Times, National Geographic, The Atlantic, Pacific Standard, Slate, Nature, and various other publications. He's now writing his fourth book, The Orchid and the Dandelion, due out in 2015, which expands on his much-discussed feature for The Atlantic, The Orchid Children. It will follow scientists and some rather extraordinary regular people as they grapple with changing ideas about how genes and culture shape temperament, behavior, evolution, and destiny. Welcome back, David.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get started, I feel like I need to give a bit of background. Occasionally, there are books published that receive an extraordinary number of negative reviews, mainly due to perceptions of flawed research or flawed interpretations of research. And because I live on the internet, I end up reading all these critiques, and I end up wanting to interview on the critiques far more than the book itself. And that's what we did the last time you were here, David. You critiqued Naomi Wolf's book, Vagina, which I very much enjoyed. Not the book. I enjoyed your critique.
Thank you. Yeah, that was a bit of a mess,
to say the least. So we are going to do that again, this time with the help of Jennifer Raff, because both of you have written a number of blog posts about Nicholas Wade's book, Troublesome Inheritance. So maybe let's start out with an overview of the book. What is it about?
Well, Wade writes this book to assert what is not a brand new idea, which is that groups of people we call races are distinguished by different genetics that separate them from one another in many ways, and that these genetic differences reflect natural selection, and that the differences make some groups fitter for modern life than others. And to no great surprise, he concludes that the group that's the fittest are basically white Westerners, Caucasians, and particularly in European culture, and as most represented in this case by British culture. This arguments have all kinds of problems. Each stage of that three-part argument has tremendous problems, and most reviewers, I among them, found that all three claims are baseless, but that they don't even all have to be baseless for the argument to fall apart.
So what is this gentleman's background exactly?
Well, he wrote for a long time. I'm not quite sure. I think about 20 years, a couple of decades at least, for the New York Times. He was one of their big science writers. He wrote about evolution a lot for them. And he also... before that, he was an editor at Nature in London. So his experience is substantial. He's been writing about science for top publications for quite a while, and so he has a lot of standing. And this is why I think a lot of people took this book quite seriously, because it would be taken seriously by a lot of people, and there was a possibility that it would be used to justify essentially racist ideas and perhaps policies. This offered to lend a scientific underpinning to racist thinking. I wouldn't want to characterize, I don't know Nicholas Wade. I write for the Times also. We've never met. I don't know him. I would hate to try to say whether he's a racist. Some people have said he's racist. I don't know if he's a racist or not, but I think he's written a book that is friendly to racist ideas.
So what's the general response to the book been?
Well, I think it's fair to say it's been fairly, it's been mixed. Some people have welcomed it. Some people who have long been making an argument that there are human differences, differences among different groups that make some groups fitter for one thing than another. And this is a strain of thinking that you can trace pretty far back, at least 150 years. Some people call it scientific racism. That's a fairly good name for it. So it's welcomed by some people, but a lot of people have really ripped into it, and many of those people, I think this is the most damning thing, is that many of those people are the very scientists whose work he draws on most heavily and critically in his book, people from the discipline of population genetics. Does that match about your assessment, Jennifer?
It does. My main concern about its reception was that, at least with the early reviews, many people were accepting as given his claims in the first half of the book, which were about the genetic basis for discrete races, whether it's 3 or 5 or 7. He seems to be confused about how many there are. The early reviews seem to accept that as being scientifically justified and focus their critiques on the what he calls the speculative second half of the book. And that's unfortunate because I can speak from personal experience. A friend of mine read the book, and she has no background in science, and she found it plausible. And when she found out, when some of the more critical reviews by geneticists started coming out, and she understood a little bit more about the fallacies of some of his claims, she was very embarrassed and upset that she had been deceived and that she had bought into these arguments so readily. But the problem is, the arguments are convincing to somebody who does not necessarily have a background in science, at least the first half of the book. So. I agree the reviews have definitely been mixed. I think they're generally the scientific community now has come out very strongly against his interpretation, his description of the genetics. But, you know, there still are some people who, if you read the Amazon reviews, find it very plausible. And that's
right.
Disturbing.
Yeah, it is disturbing. This is what makes the book dangerous. He's a lucid writer. I mean, he writes very clear, engaging prose. He's a nice, smooth writer in both the nice meaning of the word, but also in a sort of slick meaning too, because he can sort of lay out an elegant argument based on cherry-picked data and distorted readings of studies, and he does that very skillfully throughout the whole book, but especially in the first half, where I mean, it rhetorically, it's a smart play. I'm going to tell you some things that most scientists would agree on, and then I'm going to make him some speculations about what they mean. So this sounds very reasonable, but it's not reasonable when the part that he's saying he's laying out agreed upon consensus view of science is anything but, as we found out afterwards when the very scientists whose work he was citing explicitly came out and said that he had distorted the science and that it did not say what he said it said.
And also his reaction to his critics has been very interesting, and maybe we want to get into that a little bit later, but he's employed some very interesting rhetorical strategies to dance around the arguments of his critics, and I've been very impressed by how he's done that.
We have so much to talk about. I'm so excited. Okay, so, well, you've touched on a number of the criticisms, but let's get really specific. You mentioned it earlier, the idea that there are 3 major races. And in fact, many of his conclusions are built on that foundation. So that concept does not seem to hold up scientifically. Jennifer, can you talk about that? Because you wrote a brilliant blog post about this.
Sure. Well, Wade is not sure how many races there are exactly. He claims that there may be three, but then he also likes the idea of five continental races. But then sometimes he mentions that there are seven races. This discrepancy in categorization doesn't bother him, and it doesn't bother his followers at all. They've argued very frequently that this is not a big deal. But it's a little disturbing to me as a scientist, because the studies that he uses in order to make these claims don't say what he claims they say. So, for example, the argument that he makes for dividing humans up into a certain number of races, let's call it five, in his book is actually based on a paper which came out, well, there's been a couple of papers sort of related to it, but the first one he claims is Rosenberg et al., 2002, and then a later follow-up paper on 2005. And this Rosenberg paper uses a program called Structure, which divides human genetic variation into a certain number of clusters. And these clusters correspond with supposedly their population of origin, or the population of origin of the individuals included in the study. Sorry if I'm making this a little complicated.
No. Okay. We have nerdy listeners.
Good. So what Structure does is so what the Rosenberg paper presented was a example of cluster that showed different partitionings from two populations through six populations. So they allowed the algorithm to divide the variation of the people in it into either two, three, four, five, or six clusters. And then they claimed that when the number of groups was set to five, that was the best result. And actually, Rosenberg et al. didn't claim that. That's what Nicholas Wade claimed. So the limitation of the program Structure is that, first of all, it will divide populations only in up into the number of populations it asks you to divide them into. So that's a limitation. It's not giving you a definitive result that there are five human races at all. It could tell you there are 20 races. It could tell you that there are two. It's all dependent on what you ask it to do. And the second problem is that subsequent studies have sampled more populations worldwide than the Rosenberg et al. Study. And, for example, Sarah Tishkoff and her colleagues published a study in 2009 that added many, many more individuals from Africa to the same data set. And what they did was they actually statistically evaluated the fit of these different K values that they asked Structure to find. And what they found was the data supported 14 population clusters, not five. So if you were going to use this one program as your evidence for how many races there were, which has many problems and I wouldn't advise it, but if you were going to do that, as Wade is trying to do, you would actually have to say there were 14 races, not five. But that's unfortunate. He doesn't like that number. So,
and several of those, well, obviously, in each case, those five are going to be divided into more than one. And this includes the population in Africa, which would not be represented as one race the way his book does, correct?
Correct. There would be at least,
if you took the Tishkoff, right, yeah.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's worth noting that every author Jennifer just named has explicitly repudiated Wade's argument.
So just to be clear, the number five is almost completely arbitrary then.
Well, it's convenient, and that's the word that Wade uses. He says it's convenient.
He does. He kind of begs a little bit of indulgence and say, well, we'll just call it five because that's easier, and now we're going to set aside two. He's a little rude about this. Being Native Americans, Native Americans, and the others being Austronesians. And so now he's conveniently left with Asians, Caucasians, and Africans, and treats them as if they're three distinct populations that have been under distinct, coherent, selective pressures at the race slash continental level that has created these differences. There's all kinds of problems with this, but you know, as Jennifer described, there's a certain arbitrariness to dividing these things up. It's like, well, you have to, it's as if you brought them to someone and said, can you divide this stuff up? And if you bring something to me, you know, a big bucket of nuts and bolts and screws and nails, I'm going to ask how many categories do you want me to use? And I'll do that. But what's missed in all this kind of neat chopping up is that it's very important to recognize that these are spatial things, these clusters, these genetic clusters that these programs identify, and that, you know, that genetics shows differing across the world in slight ways, that they reflect geography is what they really reflect. And if you listen to Wade, you would sort of expect that if you walked from, you know, Cameroon to the Cotswold, then at some point you would suddenly stop being among the African race and suddenly be among the Caucasian race. And of course, nothing, that's not true at all. It's you're going to move through sort of a spectrum effect, and there's no one place you can draw a line and say here geographically is where one place stops and another, or where, and certainly not here's where one race stops. With these four people, I've moved from one race to another. And this is an essential thing to recognize, because it really is, it's a mix, it's a spectrum, choose your metaphor, but it's not, you know, three buckets that things are different in.
And how much of Wade's argument hinges on the whole three races idea then?
Well, he needs it, but even if you give it to him, he's still not done, because the next part of his argument is that that these races reflect different capabilities based on natural selection. Or to put it another way, he's arguing that the differences in genetics and genes between these different populations arose primarily through natural selection that has direct implications about fitness. This is an absolute essential part of his argument, and that specific part of his argument is rejected by the population geneticists who did all this work.
You're tuned in to Science for the People, and I'm joined by science writer David Dobbs and postdoctoral researcher Jennifer Raff. We're discussing Nicholas Wade's book, A Troublesome Inheritance. And we'll be right back with more of that after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
You're tuned in to Science for the People, and I'm joined by science writer David Dobbs and postdoctoral researcher Jennifer Raff. We're discussing Nicholas Wade's book, A Troublesome Inheritance.
Now, if I can ask Jennifer a question, if you've learned, like, if you remember your high school evolution through natural selection, you'll think, but wait, if there are genetic differences, doesn't it reflect natural selection? But the view of these differences, and of many differences in genetics now, is that the default answer is that it comes from a process called natural drift.
Sure.
Genetic drift. So I said natural drift. I meant genetic drift. So is that the key? His key error, Jennifer? And can you sort of do you have a good, you know, thumbnail?
Well, I actually just taught this to undergraduates in a guest lecture earlier this week, so I can kind of get at it. But the thing is that there are multiple evolutionary forces at work on our species, as with any species, and what we population geneticists see, there's a few who would argue with me, but the majority of us would say that what we see with the patterns of human variation reflect the process of what you just referred to. It's basically a sort of the isolation by distance is what we call it. That is, populations closer together are more likely to be genetically similar, geographically, that is closely together, more likely to be genetically similar than they are to populations farther away. And that's because they can exchange genes, exchange alleles more readily. You are more likely to mate with somebody in your town or close to you physically than you are necessarily to mate with somebody on the other side of the world. Now, obviously, in this day and age, those barriers have broken down quite a bit with ease of traffic and so forth. But we definitely see this pattern has existed for most of human history, that populations that do migrate away, and the farther away they migrate from more ancestral populations, the more different they become from them. But that's not to say that selection doesn't operate on human populations. It absolutely does. We see adaptations for things like skin color that reflect distance from the equator. We see adaptations for living at high altitude or for living in cold climates. But the majority of human variation is explainable, in my opinion at least, by this isolation by distance pattern. And that's what produces that gradient of human genetic diversity that you talked about earlier, that you can't just pick somebody and say, this line right here, this is the arbitrary line between this race and this race, because it just doesn't exist.
So do behavioral adaptations exist? I think that's the main argument, is it not?
That is his main argument. Yeah, mm-hmm. The selection has been on behavior, and that these three races have developed different, you know, strengths and weaknesses in their behavior through selective pressure, and they're tied in to culture. And it seems like an elegant, sort of pretty sensical argument, but it falls apart because he can't point to any genes that would do this work. He gets a bit circular there. He says, well, we see differences in behavior, and they seem to be lasting, so they must be from natural selection, which means the genes have changed. So we know there must be genes because we see the different behavior, and we know that we have the different behavior because there's been genes that have been selected for. But he can't.
And therefore, according to Wade, this is why, you know, Jews are adapted for banking and Nobel Prizes. That's taken it to the extreme, but that's what he argues.
He does. And another one of his arguments is that the Europeans became more trusting during about the year 2000, when the rule of law was made trade safer, because you had the authority of law was the ruler and could settle disputes over trade and other things, and that this made Europeans more trusting, which set up a sort of snowball effect where if you were more trusting, you were more successful, so you passed your trusting and trustworthy genes on, and that reinforced the trusting culture, which then rewarded that sort of behavior more, and so on. Whereas this didn't happen in other places that were stuck in more tribal modes. And so in Africa, for instance, he says that he says that they're less trusting there because they're stuck in a tribal mode of behavior, because they haven't been through this selective pressure that the Europeans were. And that's why their economies don't do as well, because they're not willing to extend their trust in wide enough circles to have a smooth, open, efficient economy. Whereas in Asia, they will do that, but they're not as independent-minded, so they're not as innovative as Western cultures. Now, it all has a sort of nice Aesop's fable ring to it. You know, they're pretty stories, but they simply don't hold up. And one thing that bothers me in the book is that it really shortchanges the power of culture to sustain different modes of behavior, and that cultural differences are themselves very lasting, which he wants to consider them a thing that we would change in a minute. And that lets him attribute things to the power of genes, because they're the only.
Again, he does cite a number of pieces of research, does he not?
To make those claims?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he draws on some historians whose arguments and views are friendly to him in these histories.
Doesn't he talk specifically about gene variants that do create less trust and more violence in African Americans? Now, is
he
that
does.
A real study?
He does. There are real studies that these are two. genes in play here. One is known as MAOA or MOA. A lot of people use it as shorthand. And there's a variant of that gene that some studies have found to increase aggression, particularly under people who've been raised under stressful circumstances.
Now, the stressful circumstances is a key part of that study, that it's not, you don't see the phenotype unless, as I understand the study, you are exposed to some pretty severe stress.
That is correct. It's one of those gene environment studies where both a genetic variant and an environmental variant, in this case, high severe stress during childhood, are present. So, but there are other studies that have failed to replicate those findings. Okay, so it's a mixed database to start with, and the environment is critical. He kind of leaves that out. In other words, the gene has no effect unless it's the person carrying it has been, even if you accept the studies. So he leaves all that out and simply points to the fact that this variant that, believe it or not, some people have called the warrior gene, it gets very ugly, but this variant is at higher presence in Africans than in Caucasians. It is, but it's like 4% instead of 1%. So he leans a lot of weight on this evidence base, which A, he tends to ignore the part about the environment, as Jennifer pointed out, and B, it's a very disputed piece of literature anyway. There's a lot of population geneticists who just dismiss it out of hand. The studies are small. In other words, they look at few individuals. Other studies that try to do it can't replicate them and so on. A highly disputed area of research. And it's the same story with another gene that he points at that affects the levels of oxytocin, which has been tied to, among many, many, many things, levels of trust in humans and connection to others, a feeling of bonds to others. And that is a variant that occurs at different prevalences in these different populations. But again, that literature is highly disputed, and he tends to boil that down to a gene that's all about trust when there's a lot of evidence that it's actually about in-group, out-group relations and salience and a lot of other things. So it's very early, thin evidence, highly disputed studies, and he's leaning a lot on those two genes. And those are his only offerings.
Right. And I think it's important, as Jennifer said earlier, she had a by all accounts, probably a quite intelligent friend who read the book and found this plausible. So I would really like to tear this down for anybody who might be listening who has seen that book on somebody else's coffee table. I'd like to give you some ammunition.
Sure. And it sounds very plausible because he's a very good writer. I will absolutely give him credit for that. But it is largely storytelling. I think there's a geneticist at Berkeley who wrote a very good review of this, very scathing review of this, Dr. Michael Eisen, and he actually said, Wade tries to paint himself as a courageous scholar, going places where modern evolutionary biology that scientists will not go. But the truth is, scientists don't go there not because we're afraid to, but because we can't. It's just the data do not allow us to make these inferences. And Wade is storytelling when he does.
These are attractive stories about single genes that have enough power that with a handful of single genes that are a little bit different in different populations, they can shape behavior so that they're different races distinct in behavior. And the thing that genetics has shown us over the last 10 years is that it's never that simple. There are so few simple stories in genetics that as soon as you hear one, your alarm should go loud.
Well, are there specific genes that control for specific behaviors, regardless of race?
In humans?
Mm-hmm.
Not that I know of.
I can't think of anything. But then this is a little bit outside of my field. So,
right. I remember I once asserted once that you couldn't find that, and someone pointed out there was some gene, I think it was like that made a bug dig a burrow in a certain way. So I'd hesitate to make a blanket statement. But when you're talking about highly complicated social behaviors, okay, first of all, it's very doubtful that one gene is going to drive, to have a huge sway over whether you trust people.
Oh, no. Yeah, we've never found that as far as I
right.
know. Yeah.
And the other thing it misses when you're talking about many animals, many social species, but especially humans who are so complicated because our memories and our language and our culture, those are such powerful determinants of what we think about things and our attitude about other people and our behavior and how we express any given trait. These things shape us, our behavior, so heavily that, and I think he overlooks those things wildly. When he finds cultural differences, he attributes them to genetics. It seems to me that the obvious thing to do there would be to attribute them to culture, because culture has a proven power to shape behavior.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm here with postdoctoral researcher Jennifer Raff and science writer David Dobbs. We are slowly tearing apart Nicholas Wade's book, A Troublesome Inheritance. So when we're talking about the influence that culture does have, how do we tease those apart? How do we determine what genetics is responsible for and what culture is responsible for?
Well, I think that's tricky, but there are people who have done it. There's an economist at Harvard. I read about this in another book that I'm reviewing right now. I can't tell you the name or who I'm reviewing it for. But the work was done by Nathan Nunn and a colleague of his named Wanchakan, I hope I'm not mispronouncing it, who's at Princeton. And by coincidence, they looked at trust, the issue of trust in African economies, and tried to figure out. First, they saw that what drew their attention was that the regions in Africa who today have the worst economies and have had the most, difficult economies over the last 50 years happened to be the same regions that were most exposed to slave trading and slave raiding and kidnapping 150 years ago. So that's a correlation, right? Is there a connection? And through a series of papers, they ferreted out that first they measured trust in, and this isn't all of Africa. This is different regions in Africa, right? A distinction that Wade didn't bother drawing. And teased it out through mining this questionnaire, this database of questionnaires that had already been compiled, and mining those for questions that had anything to do with trust and how willing they were to trust other people and social institutions and so on, the kind of things that are known, they're taken as faith and evidence in economics that it helps economies, and found that those levels of trust were lower in those same areas where the economies had struggled, and through pressing in some other ways, tied in a convincing manner that lack of trust, social trust, I guess that's the only kind, lack of trust to the whole history of slavery in these areas. And they could kind of trace it down through the generations. And this really speaks powerfully to how big cultural forces can have a lasting effect on people in a way that affects their behavior, and in this case just happens to affect the very dynamic that Nicholas Wade attributed to these genes. And to me, that seems a more powerful argument. So you can ferret it out, but it takes quite a bit of work. And this came to my attention recently, and I'd love to dig around and see what similar kind of work has been done. But it's rather amazing that and these studies existed. These aren't brand new studies. These were published a few years ago. And I would have to look at the index, but I don't believe Nicholas Wade mentions them.
From a genetic standpoint, there's another area that's really, really interesting, and probably your listeners have heard of epigenetics, but I think that's definitely worth paying attention to, and I don't believe Mr. Wade does, or at least mentions it very much. But epigenetics is an area where the environment and the genome interact, where your gene expression levels can be affected by the environment to which you're exposed, and those effects can be transmitted to your children and to your grandchildren. And the way it works is chemical modifications to your genome actually occur in response to stress and in response to other environmental factors. And those can in some cases, be those modifications can be passed down to, I think we know of two generations that it's possible. So that a person who experiences, for example, slavery and the stress that occurred as a result of that may have passed it down to her children and her grandchildren. So the environment can have lasting effects on your genes in a way that we're only just now starting to understand.
So there are a number of ways of researching these types of things, just none of which Wade wanted to look at.
I can't speak to what he wanted to do, but he failed to,
yeah,
which would seem to be the thorough way to go about it.
I'm sorry, that was terribly leading of me.
We didn't bite.
okay, go ahead, David.
No, go ahead.
I noticed that in one of your blog posts, David, you called a troublesome inheritance deeply flawed, deceptive, and dangerous. And you used the word dangerous previously on this episode. So I understand the flawed and deceptive bit, but can you explain the dangerous part?
Well, because this is a dangerous book. To me, this is one of the things Wade says. He says that there's been a strain in genetics for a while, that there's a lot of researchers now that feel the way he feels, believe that they see the things that he describes. They see the human genetics and race. They see race as biological. They agree with him, but they're afraid to speak out. And that he says it's time we stop being so tender about this. It's safe now to talk about this, he says, because essentially, he says, the opposition to racism is deeply entrenched enough to make this safe. Now, I don't know where he grew up. He didn't grow up where I grew up. I grew up in Texas, and it's still not safe to talk about race in Texas. It's still not – race is still a huge issue in the world and in this country. And, you know, bad luck for Nick Wade, but the months since he published those words, it's been demonstrated again and again and again that it's an explosive issue. Now – If he's making a deeply fact-based argument, fine. Maybe it is time to talk about it, but he's failing to. And I think when you recognize that something is so latent as this is, you should set a higher bar for yourself. And my frustration is that he does not. He talks about this as if it's okay. He makes specious arguments. He cherry picks. He tells stories, all in service of an argument that where is he going to go with it? This is not a helpful argument. And again, if it's incontrovertible, then let's deal with it. It's far from incontrovertible. It's speculative. It's poorly made. It's distorting. And it's dangerous because racism is dangerous. It's a toxic, ugly thing in this country.
Jennifer, did you want to add anything there?
Well, I think it's very telling to look at how Mr. Wade responds to his critics. When the first major reviews of his book came out in the Huffington Post, they were by myself and John Hawks and Augustin Fuentes and John Marks, and he did not treat them seriously. At least in factual, he didn't respond to our as a factual rebuttal to our arguments. Instead, he attacked us. He attacked me by saying I was a student, which is not true. He said I was a postdoctoral student. And then he basically dismissed the rest of my incredibly long argument against him. And he attacked Augustin Fuentes and John Marks by saying that they were not good scholars. I'm paraphrasing a bit, but...
Well, they're not geneticists.
They're not geneticists, yes, and they don't have standing, therefore, to critique his argument, because I guess they don't understand it. And as a general critique of all of us, he said that we were anthropologists and therefore politically correct and therefore repressing the biologists with our wicked ways and trying to prevent them from talking about race or thinking about race. And these are all ridiculous arguments. First of all, I would consider myself just as much a biologist as I am an anthropologist. I have training in both. But second of all, because it assumes that we're not talking about race, but we are. The field of genetics, the field of biological anthropology, we talk about human genetic variation all the time. That's kind of the point of our field. And as far as I've observed, I've not seen anybody repressing anybody else in that regard. But it's a convenient argument for him to make because it's a way for him to get out of any uncomfortable situation, any uncomfortable critique. Sort of an escape hatch. So when 139 of the most eminent geneticists in human biology, including people whose work he was citing, repudiate his argument, he just says, oh, they're being intimidated by the cultural anthropologists, or they didn't read my work.
Either. Because geneticists are routinely really intimidated by cultural anthropologists. They're terrified of cultural anthropologists. This is an extraordinary thing. If you look at this list, that so the letter we're talking about was written to the New York Times, that because I reviewed the book for the New York Times Book Review, and then like 140 plus geneticists, some were in other fields, but mainly most of them were geneticists from population genetics, the very field he drew on, all signed on to a letter that they sent to the Times Book Review saying very specifically, he's misrepresenting the discipline. We do not agree with his conclusion. He's wrong. This is, if you know a little bit about the geneticist community, the idea that you could get 140 people to sign anything is rather incredible. I mean, there's, you know, there's a healthy amount of spirited disagreement and infighting among geneticists, along with rivalries and all the usual things. And I was beyond impressed. I was amazed that somebody managed to pull this off.
Yes. So I have to ask, is there value to trying to determine if certain behaviors are genetic, and if they are, then are they specifically associated with race? I mean, if science could figure out an answer to that question, would it be helpful?
Well, I think any question is open to exploration. I really do in science. But I don't see how we could get there yet. We have so little understanding of human genetic variation right now as it is in differences in specific alleles for specific traits and the interplay between those that I'm not sure. I think we're a long way away from that. At least that's how I read it.
Yeah, I would agree. I think there's two things to keep in mind. One, that the more we look at this, as Jennifer was describing before, when you look at the when you're trying to see what are the variations, the genetic differences in the human population, and the main thing that jumps out is that the differences are tied to place, right, where you came from and where your ancestors were and who they mated with to, you know, create a line that got to you. So, and it's a bunch of little dots, all of slightly different shades if you represent it on a map. So it's the variety that keeps coming out, not that they increasingly are grouped into tight, distinct categories. So that's a trend to pay attention to over the last 10 years or more. And the other thing to keep in mind, I think, is how incredibly early we are in genetics. It's really early in this discipline, so that yes, we should look and see how humans are selected for and how selection works in humans, but we should be careful about drawing bold, definitive conclusions. And this was the troubling thing about Wade's book. At a time when geneticists are, I talk a lot with geneticists on Twitter, and we make jokes about there are no genes for anything because...
That's
because
true.
Any, right, Jennifer?
Yeah. You're right. We can't... almost nothing. I mean, even height, I think, is the one that we have the most clear association with, and even that is overinterpreted. I mean, yeah, it's a
right.
problem.
And there's many, to the extent they can determine it, it's many, many genes, what, dozens for height, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the way that people really should think about this is a very complex interplay of many, many, many different loci genes interact together in order to produce phenotypes. There
right.
are some cases, very few cases, where you have one gene equals one phenotype, but that is very rare. In most cases, it's a very complex interaction of many different genes. And I think it's a hard idea to wrap your brain around sometimes, I think. But it's that complexity, that uncertainty and ambiguity that's where we're working right now. And we just don't have a great handle on it yet.
Yeah, it's really early, and it's complicated, and it's probably far more complicated when you start to talk about behavior.
Yes.
Because behavior is an enormous, like social behavior is this just incredibly complicated thing that we don't have any handle on really. And so this is what troubled me about Wade's book was he takes the most complicated stuff and he comes to us with this argument that, you know what, it's time we face an inconvenient truth. The science shows that there are three races. Well, five, but we're going to forget about these two. There are three races. They are fit. They have different levels of fitness for modern society. This is his argument, and we need to deal with this in some kind of realistic way. Now, again, if all everything before the last sentence was true, fine, let's deal with it. But there's no reason to have confidence in any of those parts of his argument.
Okay, are there any other problem areas that we haven't discussed that you think maybe are important to talk about?
Well, I think one of Wade's rhetorical strategies has been very interesting to see it employed both by him and by his defenders, and that's his use of sloganeering, I guess is a term for it, where he uses this catchphrase that's very simple, just that human evolution is recent, copious, and regional, and he repeats it again and again and again, and you can't really object to that because it's true that humans have evolved and they continue to evolve recently. But it's a stand-in for a much more loaded argument. And he claims that if you disagree with his argument, then you must disagree with this nice phrase. And it's very, very difficult to argue with because they're saying different things. And by implication, you're rejecting evolution if you reject this phrase. It's a very sort of insidious plot, I think, to get you to tumble over your own words, you know.
David, did you want to add anything?
No, I think she did that well. His arguments, his counters to the critiques, he has said quite a few times that no one has addressed the specifics of his argument, which is kind of strange because if you read all the different posts, especially the ones who come from biologists,
right,
they have been extremely specific about addressing particulars of his argument. So it's a strange gambit, but whether it works or not, I don't know.
And as you said earlier, David, it's that he comes across as so rational.
He is. He's not just a lucid writer. He's an elegant writer, and he has this voice of a very reasonable person. It's a voice of someone you want to keep listening to, and you are inclined to believe. And a lot of people, as we've discussed, have read the book and are convinced that he has the basics right, and this gives his speculative argument more authority. But it's an authority that I don't think is earned with a good read of the literature.
David, Jennifer, you both are lovely, and thank you for making your way through that book for us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
And we've linked to Jennifer Raff, anthropological geneticist at the University of Texas, and science writer David Dobbs on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we'll be back with more Science for the People after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
And now I think we need a palate cleanser. And what better palate cleanser than a cookie? My guest is science education writer and blogger Bethany Brookshire. And Bethany has a BS in biology and a BA in philosophy from the College of William and Mary, and a PhD in physiology and pharmacology from Wake Forest University School of Medicine. And of course, she blogs at Eureka Lab and is also known as the lovely PsyCurious. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So what I wanted you to do this time is to come and talk to us about a series of posts that you wrote on Eureka Lab about cookie science. But first of all, who is the Eureka Lab? Who are they aimed at?
Oh, so Eureka Lab is our new science education project that is run by Society for Science and the Public, which is the nonprofit that runs Science News, the illustrious magazine for which I also write. And the Eureka Lab is a new concept. We are writing for middle and high school students. So everything on Eureka Lab is written at the 7th grade level, which is much more challenging than you might think. but it's also fully understandable and actually really interesting to many adults as well. We are trying to reach the middle and high school audiences to inspire them in science and say, here are things that you can try for yourself. Here are other cool middle and high school students who have done amazing science, you know, in labs or on their own. Here's a lot of really great science that you can try. And the whole idea behind Eureka Lab is that science is accessible. Science is right there. It's just a matter of, you know, asking a question and then going about finding an answer scientifically.
And hence the cookie science. So what is this sort of blog series about?
So this is actually a full series. It's probably going to be about 16 posts. It's still in progress. It's designed to help students in middle and high school understand how to design and carry out a scientific experiment. And this is partially just to give them information about how science is actually done, but it's also to help students who are doing things like applying for science fairs, because the Society for Science and the Public runs the Intel Science Talent Search, it runs the International Science and Engineering Festival, and it runs the Broadcom Masters, which is the middle school science fair. And so they want to encourage more kids to try these projects, you know, try and develop a full scientific experiment and submit it. But a lot of kids, you know, don't necessarily understand. They know the scientific method, you know, they know hypothesis, they know test the hypothesis, but they don't really know on a detailed level how that's going to work. And so I've designed and I'm carrying out an experiment to show how the scientific method can be applied to something really close to home. You don't have to go, oh, I need to test a bunch of cells in a Petri dish. No, you can bake cookies. And that's just awesome.
And so making cookies could, in effect, stand in for any science question that someone wants answered.
Yes, yes. Much in the way that tossing cookies usually represents vomiting, making cookies can represent science. It's much more positive.
You are the biggest dork I have ever met. So now, you mentioned sort of in this series, you explained how to develop a hypothesis, to design an experiment, to prevent bias, which was great. But there's also a post on ethics.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a bit?
So in this experiment, I am, just to give you the basic hypothesis, I am creating, my goal, which is not a hypothesis, is to create a gluten-free cookie for my friend Natalie. Okay, she has celiac disease. She cannot eat gluten. And so I would like to create a version of my favorite cookie, the Alton Brown Chewy recipe, that she can eat. So in order to do that, I need to form a series of hypotheses and I need to bake a bunch of cookies. But in order to create a cookie that is comparable, I actually need to have people test it. So they need to eat it. And that means you run into issues of ethics. And every scientific experiment is going to have issues of ethics. It's important that you not lie, obviously. But if you are working with, say, animals, it's important that you treat them ethically. And if you're working with people, it's also important that you not only treat them ethically, you obtain their consent, which is part of treating them ethically. And that you make sure that they understand what's going on, that they remain unbiased while understanding what's going on, which is fun. And that you don't do anything that might potentially harm them. And so to do that, I actually, before I started baking cookies, I obtained Institutional Review Board approval, that's IRB approval, for testing on human subjects so that I can feed people cookies.
I love this. I love the fact that you're explaining study design ethics to children. And I don't know if I've actually ever seen that kind of scientific safety discussion aimed at youth before, because it's, you know, we hear a lot of, how can we explode this thing without blowing our fingers off? That's more of the safety discussion we have.
Hey, that's an important question. I think it's important to discuss early. You know, a lot of kids, they read science news, or for example, they might read our site, Science News for Students, which is freaking awesome. If you haven't seen it, my editor writes it, Janet Roloff. She's really good. And they see all these studies involving humans. You know, they have humans drinking coffee or humans getting treated for different kinds of cancer or, you know, all these kind of things. Most people, adults and teens included, probably don't think much about where those people come from, why they've signed up, what they're getting out of this. How do you make sure that when you're giving somebody a cancer drug, you're not hurting them more than they, you know, you're not causing harm? I think it's an important question to think about early when you realize how scientific experiments are conducted. And that also kind of tells you a lot about what the results are going to be like and why some results from studies are the way they are. You know, some studies are going to have limitations because there are things you cannot do to people, and that's okay. You know, so I think it's very important to point that out, very early on. But I'm also doing other aspects associated with designing scientific method and stuff. I'm currently working on a several part piece on statistics and how and why we conduct statistics. For seventh graders, because I like challenges.
This is fantastic. Okay, so as of this recording, the series is not done. So
no.
The last one that I read was Baking It Up. So what are the upcoming lessons that you have planned?
Well, so there's actually, the Baking It Up is describing the actual baking of the first experiment, including all of the crazy stuff that I went through. I made sure I put cookies, the different batches on the cookie sheet at the same time. I made sure they were all chilled in the fridge for the same amount of time. I made sure that I checked things like cookie spread. So I measured with a tape measure the raw cookie dough and then like the baked cookie dough. I measured the cookie dough. Each cookie dough was measured out with a scoop so they would all be the same size. Each one had exactly 5 chocolate chip cookies pressed into them by hand in exactly the same position so that people wouldn't have, you know, people wouldn't be influenced in their cookie taste by the fact that theirs had more or less chocolate. It's an important variable. So the next one's coming up. We're talking about statistics. We're also talking about, you know, getting people to eat your cookies and getting them to fill out surveys, which is sometimes kind of challenging. and then we're going to talk about results, and we're also going to talk about follow-up experiments based on your results.
Are you going to do a post on interpreting data per chance?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because especially, you know, after almost an hour of David and Jennifer talking about how easy it is to misinterpret studies, I feel like that's an important topic for children and adults.
There's going to be stuff on doing statistics on your data and also interpreting your data. And there's going to be a whole post on the potential limitations of my project, because every project has its limitations.
I love all of this, and I think that more people should be reading this. I've read all these blog posts, and they are not just for you. But I would say, as a parent, if this is something that that you think your child might be interested in, we will link to this in the comments section for this week's show. I have one study design question for you.
Yeah.
So you added food coloring to each batch.
I did.
So, and why was that? Maybe explain that first.
So I actually, I didn't want to say, hey guys, here, test this control cookie and these two gluten-free varieties, because people have preconceived notions
right.
about how gluten-free things are going to taste. I needed to make sure they were blind to the conditions. And so, which actually there's a limitation on that, because gluten affects texture. And it also affects a cookie's appearance very strongly. And so the cookies look different. There's no helping that. They look different. But in order to try and fool people as much as possible so they wouldn't come into this with bias, I color-coded the cookies. So each recipe and, you know, each variable I'm testing is a different color.
Okay, so, and herein lies my question. Studies have been done on pharmaceuticals showing that people have different responses to pills when they're different colors, right?
Yep.
So could the same thing potentially happen with cookies? Maybe blue gluten-free cookies would be rated higher than the green gluten-free cookies? But
that is certainly a possibility. I'm trying to get around that. In my second experiment, I switched up the colors.
Oh, look at you.
So that the control is a different color. And the, you know, one of the gluten-free varieties is a different color.
So that's not just me being difficult then?
No, actually, that was the first question a lot of people asked. It's a good question. Yeah.
Bethany, you are great. Come back anytime for anything, honestly.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. And I mean, definitely check out Cookie Science. We are totally excited about this series. And most importantly, if people want to bake along, one of the things we're really interested in is replication. And while not everybody's going to get IRB approval to test cookies on multiple different people, you can do things like measure the spread of your cookies and tell me if you get my data too, because replication is one of the most important things in science. So if anybody wants to replicate my cookies, I would love it. It would be awesome.
And of course, we have linked to Bethany Brookshire and the Cookie Science series on the Eureka Lab on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And we've also linked to every conceivable place that we can be found on social media, as well as iTunes, so that you can download past episodes or subscribe to the program. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People. Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Schell.